Welcome to the Twisted Podcast. My name's Trina, talking with Steph Bradshaw today. Steph K. Equestrian, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am good. Horses are amazing creatures. I know so many people just fall in love with them. I've had friends tell me they're like a dog, but just huge.
Yeah, that's a pretty accurate description.
Well, how is your horse training different from traditional methods?
So traditional horse training is what I grew up with, and that's how I was trained for the majority of my life and how I competed. It operates on the idea of pressure release, which is something that if you're in the horse community, you probably heard a million times. So pressure release is this idea that you apply pressure to a horse, and that's some sort of like motivating stimulus. It can be like a tactile touch. It can also be something like maybe a whip or a chain, something unpleasant. And in the neurological community, which is where my background is, we actually refer to that pressure as an adverse stimulus. So it's something that's unpleasant to the animal, to the learner. And then when the learner does what you want them to do and the horse behaves, you release that pressure. So that's where you get that pressure release. It is a punishment-based and a force-based method. So essentially, you're applying some sort of adverse stimulus, something unpleasant to the horse. The horse wants to get away from that stimulus, so they change their behavior or do something to try and get away from it. And then when they do the correct thing, you release it. And that's how they learn. That's how they know that they did the right thing, is from that release. It is somewhat effective. However, my biggest problem was that it didn't seem like the most ethical way to be training an animal. Like I said, my background is in neurology. I've worked with a wide variety of species. And all of these species, we follow these basic ethical guidelines where we try to do things that are as pleasant and the least invasive for the animal. So we want to try and make things a positive experience for them. We don't want them to feel uncomfortable or afraid or feel like their basic needs are being violated. So when we're working with all of these different types of animals, and when I was working with them in university in my neurology programs, we would use a positive reinforcement and force-free approach. So some of the basic guidelines were we wanted to use minimal restraint, minimal force, and try to get the animal to cooperate with us willingly. That was especially important for the larger animals. So a little bit backwards than how I was taught in the horse community. I was always taught they're big animals. You need to have control over them. You need to show them who's boss, that sort of attitude, because otherwise it's unsafe. But then in the animal behavior community, whenever you have small animals, you might use a little more restraint or something like that. But with a large animal, it was actually thought you should use minimal restraint because it's more dangerous to try and restrain an animal who is a lot stronger than you than it is to try and get them to just willingly cooperate with you. Over time, I started to really rethink how I was training horses. Once I had the terminology and the understanding of exactly why what I was doing was working, it really made me feel uncomfortable how much punishment I was giving to my horses. The entire idea was you use positive punishment, which is the application of an adverse stimulus, to motivate the horse. So I'm essentially punishing them for whatever they're doing. Let's use the example of the horses standing still and you're trying to ride them. You kick with your legs. And that's an unpleasant stimulus. If they don't listen, you might escalate that to the use of like a spur or a whip or something along those lines. And you're essentially punishing the horse for standing still. And then once they move forward, you stop kicking your leg. That's the release. That's how they know that was the correct way to escape that type of adverse stimulus. Then you want the horse to stop. So now they're going forward. You want that to stop. So you punish that behavior by pulling back on the bit, which is in the horse's mouth. You pull back and it's uncomfortable and the horse wants to escape that pressure. And so they slow down. And then when they do, you release that pressure. So that's sort of the basic learning that we do with horses, is this pressure release. It's not necessarily the most ethical way to be doing things. And it's definitely not the way we do things in the rest of the animal behavior community. So there were a few horses that definitely prompted me along to be trying this new type of training, horses that didn't respond well to the traditional training, as well as one particular horse who was very large and was actually quite dangerous with this type of like restraint-based and force-based training. And so I decided to approach him like I would a big cat. And horses aren't big cats, but I thought, you know, a big cat is a lot more dangerous than a horse. They're a lot stronger in some ways and definitely have sharper teeth. But maybe if I approach this horse with the same guidelines I would take with some other large, dangerous animal, I'll be able to make some progress the same way we do with the large, dangerous animals that I train in my university program. So I did that. I started approaching him with force-free methods. I used protective contact and I used positive reinforcement. So positive reinforcement is the application of a pleasant stimulus to motivate the animal. So rather than punishing them with something adverse, a pressure, whether it's a tactile touch, a whip, a chain, a spur, whatever, instead I'm going to use something pleasant. I'm going to use maybe food or maybe like scratches or pets, like something that is pleasant to them, so that that way they want to be cooperating with me and they're trying to seek that rather than trying to avoid the unpleasant.
Talking with Steph Bradshaw from Steph K Equestrian, what was your focus of study at university?
I studied behavioral neuroscience. So it's sort of the science behind why animals think and do the things they do. And there was a lot of emphasis on animal training. So I spent a lot of time interning at like the zoo and the aquarium and working with different types of animals, different species, and working with their trainers. And that's one of the things that really prompted me to change how I do things with horses, because I would see all of this work with all these different species, and we trained all of them the exact same way. Well, not the exact same, but similar guidelines. And then we totally like were backwards with horses. We didn't follow those guidelines at all. In fact, we did the exact opposite of those guidelines. Everything I had learned had said when you're working with a large animal, particularly one that's stronger than you and you're in like full contact with them, there's no protective barriers or anything like that. You want to try to avoid use of restraint, avoid use of force, avoid use of punishment-based learning. And then with horses, those were like the main three things we do is we restrain them, we use force, and we use punishment. It was weird to me that most people in the horse community were telling me, oh, you have to do this. It's the only safe way to interact with them because they're so large and they can be dangerous. And I would look at the big cats and even like larger animals that we got to see on occasion, even like elephants and stuff like that. And although you can use restraints, you can use punishment, the consensus in the animal behavior community was that that was an unsafe way to interact with those animals, that a positive reinforcement approach, a force-free approach that takes precautions in terms of protective contact, using protective barriers and that sort of thing is way safer than trying to go full contact with an animal and then trying to force and restrain it into something when it's a lot stronger than you.
How long did it take for you to realize you were onto something, that you noticed that they were responding to this method?
Well, the first time I tried this with horses was with a horse named Bear. He's a big warm blood that I have. He's about 18 hands tall, which means that he's quite a few inches taller than me at his shoulder. He was actually bred to go to the Olympics. He has Olympic bloodlines, which means that he is very athletic and very, very strong. And I got him and he seemed like I could tell he was a very sweet horse, but unfortunately he had this sort of explosive behavior where he would be one horse one second and then something would change and he would just snap and get incredibly dangerous. He would throw his riders, and he was very talented at throwing his riders. If he did not want you on his back, you were not going to stay on his back. And he would actively, like, he would run at his riders. He would shove them, push them, trample them. He never bit or kicked or did anything along those lines. However, there was tons of dangerous behavior. And over time, I noticed that it was prompted by pressure. And it didn't have to be intense pressure. I was never doing anything rough with him or anything like that. Even when I did traditional training, I was not, like, I never used big spurs or harsh whips or anything like that. But just the lightest bit of pressure, he saw as a threat and he saw as force. And he had learned over time that if the human applies a pressure, you have to do some sort of behavior and then the human will stop the pressure. Unfortunately, he had learned a really effective way to stop that pressure, which was just to toss your rider in the dirt and run the opposite direction as fast as you can. And that gets the human to stop telling you what to do. If you just toss them in the dirt or somehow incapacitate them and then you run the other way, they can't do anything. And so pressure release really wasn't an option. The moment you started to apply pressure he didn't like, he would just run right over you. Or if you were on his back, he would throw you and then he would bolt. And he's big enough, he's strong enough, there's nothing that I could do about that. And so I was having these thoughts about how I felt like the training was a little backwards. I didn't like that it was punishment based. And I was sort of considering trying positive reinforcement with the horses. And so I figured that Bear would be the perfect horse to try that with. So I went out one day and I had a clicker and I had some treats and I clicked it and he bolted in the other direction as fast as he could. He thought it was the scariest noise in the world. And I gave up for a few weeks, and then I tried again, and that time I tried putting the clicker in my pocket so it wasn't quite as like loud of a noise, and he liked it a little more. I gave him some treats ahead of time so he would stay close to me, and pretty soon he learned the click, and that's when I started clicker training my first horse. And I made probably 100 mistakes at least in the first year or so that I did this. But I noticed that his demeanor was changing over time. I didn't quite know how to train the behaviors. Like, I did a lot of things wrong, and I made things a lot harder on myself because I didn't quite have the techniques perfected. But I noticed that he was wanting to try new things a lot more. And sort of his outlook on life changed. Rather than expecting me to bring punishment and adverse stimulus to him, he started expecting me to bring pleasant things to him. He wanted me to be around. He wanted to be around me. He would follow me everywhere I went like a little puppy dog. And one of the biggest things that I noticed too was that it changed how he looked at other things in the world too. He used to be rather spooky. If he saw something new, he automatically assumed it was a threat and went into sort of a prey flight mode type response. And he would startle at it or spook at it or refuse to go near it. And pretty soon he started looking at new things as opportunities to get treats. And it was stuff like that and just the affect of the horses where they started to look at the world in a different light. Like it was a good, pleasant place to be. And everything was an opportunity to get new treats rather than an opportunity to get punished. And that was probably the biggest drive, just make a 100% switch to being totally force-free and positive reinforcement-based, was just seeing how their emotional state and their psychological state totally changed. I no longer had spooky horses. I no longer had fearful horses. And I no longer had horses that fought me on anything. There was no more bucking, no more rearing, no more kicking. There was no more conflict between me and the horses. Everything melted away because suddenly the horse didn't want to fight with me, and the horse wasn't afraid of the world. The horse wanted to participate in the training. They wanted to perform for me. And on top of that, the world was a happier place.
That's great. Have others adopted this method too?
There are some others that also use positive reinforcement-based training. Not everybody does it exactly the same way. And a lot of us learned a similar way to how I learned, which was trial and error. So there are some other big names I know on social media that have platforms where they try to help spread positive reinforcement. I know Adele Shaw from The Willing Equine has a podcast and a YouTube series. I believe one of the really popular ones is the Jet Reel podcast with Jill Treese. And she talks a lot about some of the ethics behind it as well as the science behind it. She's pursuing her master's in clinical psychology. And she took a lot of courses in like behavior research and that sort of stuff whenever she was an undergrad. So she has a very like scientific background, which I think definitely helps. But for the most part, there are not a lot of positive reinforcement trainers out there. I know that we do exist. There are plenty of us, but when you compare the numbers, there are definitely a lot more traditional trainers than there are positive reinforcement trainers. But however, I definitely think there's a change going on in the sport, particularly when we look at people who train for sport and for pleasure versus people who train as a means of work and for their livelihood. So one of the main reasons that we train horses with force and why the training like adopted those procedures, one of the main reasons that training ended up being so force-based and based around all that stuff is because horses were beasts of burden. Back in the day, if your horse didn't move forward to plow the field, then your family was going to starve. So whether the horse wants to or not, it's going to move, even if it takes a whip or a chain or whatever is necessary, because the horse's health and comfort was not a priority over the farm work that had to get done and that sort of thing. But nowadays we have tractors, we have trucks, we don't rely on horses for everyday living, and it's not a necessity to have them work and perform for us. Instead, we do it for sport and for pleasure. Those are the main two things. And if you're trying to interact with an animal and use them for riding for the sake of a sport or for pleasure, it's just not fair to compromise their welfare and their own comfort and feeling of safety and security just for the sake of being able to go on a nice trail ride or so that you can compete in a sport. And so I think a lot of people are making the switch to positive reinforcement because they want to make sure that the equines are willing participants. They don't want to be forcing an animal to compete and to perform for them when they could be getting the animal to do that willingly in ways that honestly are a lot easier than the traditional training methods.
Talking with Steph Bradshaw from Steph K Equestrian, do you teach the method?
Yes, absolutely. I told myself over and over again when I was younger doing traditional training that I would never have a lesson school, which is like the barns that teach lessons. Whenever I would see lesson schools, and I actually taught at several to make extra money, all of the horses were so miserable and unhappy. And I told myself over and over, I am never going to have a lesson barn. It is just so cruel to the horses and I'm never going to do it. And now I own a lesson barn and I have 18 equines on my property and I do teach lessons. However, I have found a way to do it in a very ethical manner. So the biggest thing was making sure the horses are willing. The horses aren't forced to do anything. The way Stephanie Equestrian is set up, I am primarily a rescue organization. So I take in rescue horses. Well, I'll say rescue equines because sometimes there are donkeys or donkey crosses, but primarily horses that are in need. Usually I am their last chance. Usually they are either set for euthanasia or headed to slaughter and they come to me instead. I'm able to intervene and take them to my property. And there I rehabilitate them. Once they're rehabilitated to a certain extent, they can start participating in lessons with my lesson students. My students might do groundwork with them. They might do some of the preliminary stuff, getting them used to brushing or tacking or even just interacting with people. A lot of my students really love trick training. They like to teach the horses tricks. And so I'll see them, like, maybe they'll come to a riding lesson with the more advanced horses that have been rehabilitated a little longer and are ready to do under saddle work. And then afterwards, I'll see them just walk around the fields and teach all the horses to smile, which is a really common trick that they really enjoy teaching. My goal is to rescue as many horses as I can, rehabilitate them using positive reinforcement and force-free training methods on top of good farrier and veterinary care, and just generally good nutrition and other things that horses need to thrive. And then once they start to get rehabilitated, they enter into the lesson program. And the lesson program is sort of a sister program to the rescue because it, for one, it financially supports the rescue. People that come in from the public and pay for lessons are the reason that I am able to rescue so many horses and afford to take care of all of them, as well as it provides educational outreach. So I'm able to teach people how I rehabilitate these horses, how to properly care for and handle them so that fewer and fewer horses will hopefully end up needing to be rescued because we have a generation of really awesome equestrians that know what they're doing and know how to care for their horses properly.
So about how long does it take to train a horse?
That is a good question. A lot of people expect 30 days. That's sort of the industry standard is 30 days of training for however many dollars. But that is rarely the case. Typically, when I take in a rescue, the first month on the property, we do absolutely nothing. They typically have to be in quarantine, and so I can't really do much with them anyways. But they really just need time to settle in and relax. Before you can train a horse, they need to feel that all of their needs are met. And I could go on for a long time explaining to you all the needs of the horse, but I won't go into that much detail. But essentially, good care. If any animal isn't getting their needs met, whether it's nutritional or their safety or their environmental needs, then they're not going to be happy and relaxed, and they're going to have behavioral issues. So the first thing I do is just make them feel that their needs are met. Depending on the horse, that could take anywhere from a month to maybe a year or even more. I have a few horses that have been with me going on like 2 years now, and they're just finally starting to get truly relaxed and settled in, whereas I have other horses that might come to me and within a couple weeks, they're totally content and happy. So that's the biggest one that might take up some time is just getting them relaxed and happy and to a baseline normal. Then when it comes to the training, it depends on what type of training we're doing. Typically, it takes me about anywhere from like 15 to 30 sessions to get a rider onto a horse. So that's from the horse knowing absolutely nothing to the horse having a rider sit on their back, not riding around, not doing anything fancy. We're not going to shows, just carrying a person on their back for the first time. Now that said, I typically don't do those sessions back to back, so it's not necessarily going to be 15 days and there you go, your horse has a rider on it. It might be 15 days spread out over several months, but typically for the most part, within 6 months to a year, the horses are ready to go into the lesson program to do basic under saddle work. And within 1 to 2 years, the horses are ready to be adopted out into a new home because at that point, they're usually pretty solid on their riding foundations and they know what's expected from them in life. And so they should be somewhat reliable even if they move to a new property and have a new person. They should still sort of know the routine and be well trained enough that the training will hold through those transitions.
Okay, so your camps, you also offer lessons for kids with elevated needs, and how can you explain some of the benefits to individuals that come to you for therapeutic horse lessons?
Absolutely. I do get quite a few kids with elevated needs that come out to work with me. One of the big draws to hippotherapy or any type of like equine therapy with kids or adults that have elevated needs is the physical benefits. There's a lot of physical strength and coordination that comes from working with horses. There's a lot of good that comes from the routine of having to follow multi-step directions that are always the same. So having that routine of you get your horse, you brush your horse, exactly which brushes you use, in what order you use them. Some brushes you might do a circle motion, some you do like a straight line motion, so that motor coordination, as well as the actual riding itself. Whenever kids are riding the horses, if the kids have any sort of physical or mobility issues, riding the horse can mimic certain patterns of like walking and jogging, which can be really beneficial for kids that might have some like mobility issues, as well as even kids without mobility issues that might have some sort of motor coordination or any sort of like physical disability. It can really help them with like a whole body like balance and coordination, as well as just being honestly therapeutic in a way I can't even describe with having another animal there. And it's something that a lot of animal people try to describe, that like therapeutic benefit of dogs and cats and horses and every animal out there. And there's something about having that connection to another living creature that is just very, very therapeutic and beneficial. Now, on top of the physical benefits, I find that there are a lot of psychological benefits, especially from the fact that we do positive reinforcement-based training. There are definitely some very like mechanical aspects. We have like set numbers of repetitions we do before we ask for different behaviors. We have lots of routine, which can be really helpful. We do multi-step directions. I might tell them they have to walk up to the horse, pat its shoulder, run their hand down its leg, ask them to lift their foot up, and then clean out the hoof. And when they first come out there, that might be way too many directions for them to follow. Following multi-step directions at the barn will make it a lot easier for them to follow those directions in life, whether it be at home or at school, because they're learning it in a safe environment where I'm able to break things down really carefully, and everything has a very set purpose. Every time you're brushing the horse or cleaning out its hooves or anything like that, everything is very meaningful and purposeful. So then when it comes time to sit down in math class and do long division, something that might seem really abstract to them, the concept of multi-step directions is already pretty solid from doing the horseback riding lessons and learning about cleaning the barn and stuff like that. So it's a lot easier for them to adapt in situations where maybe the expectations are a little more abstract than they are at the barn. So with the positive reinforcement training, there's a lot that the kids learn about psychology and about behavior and about consequence. Because we train animals with consequence-based learning, I always tell them that we have this set chain of reactions when you interact with an animal. You give them some sort of prompt, they give you a behavior in response, and then you give them their consequence. And all of those things can be good or bad. You can give a good prompt or a bad prompt. The horse can give you a pleasant behavior or an unpleasant behavior. And then you can give them a reward or a punishment. And I find that this is really beneficial, especially with kids that have behavioral problems, to help them sort of rationalize why maybe sometimes in life they're in that trainer role versus the learner role. And it helps them to learn that maybe sometimes when they give certain behaviors, they're going to get different consequences, as well as when they're in situations where they can maybe prompt certain behaviors, what they're doing might lead others to make different responses. So helping them understand prompting, behavior, and consequence, and how interactions with people and how you treat people can impact how they treat you in the future. Making it, again, sort of simplifying it and making it really concrete for them using the horses, because horses are very intelligent. However, they're also very simple. They exist in the moment. They exist in that three-step interaction. So they're just going to give you a behavior and you're going to give them a consequence, and they don't really think further than that. And so for a lot of kids that have maybe some cognitive disabilities, it's hard for them to figure out what's going on with other people and why are people behaving a certain way? Why are they treating me a certain way? Why did I get this consequence? And so when they get to break it down into really simple steps with the horses, it helps them to sort of frame that in their mind later on when they're interacting with other people.
How did you learn that you could connect people and horses together?
So I started teaching lessons when I was pretty young, doing traditional training when I was a teenager. I didn't really like it very much. As I said earlier, I never wanted to have a lesson barn. However, when I started doing positive reinforcement training, I realized that there was just this huge void. We needed more people to do positive reinforcement training. We needed more horse people to understand the ethics and the rationale behind their training and why maybe they should or shouldn't be using it, as well as the horses needed it. The horses need more people that understand their needs and their behaviors and why they do certain things and how to communicate with them and how they communicate with us. Pretty soon, I had sort of this vision in my head of working with rescue horses, working with people and teaching them how to interact with the rescue horses. And I will admit it started out very horse-centered. I wasn't really thinking much about the impacts on the people. It was more about the horses for me. But pretty soon I started getting more and more clients that maybe were special needs or elevated needs, whether they're kids or adult, that had just a lot going on in life or maybe some disabilities that caused some distress or some challenges in life. And I watched how working with the horses really, really helped them, as well as really, really helping their horses. Over time, I think that my focus really did shift. It's still very much focused on the horses, but I've also opened up a lot of like my program pieces and the way that I teach and the way that I train are also now involving helping the people to expand themselves, not just focused on training the horses.
Do you have any stories that stand out to you?
I'd like to tell you about Rosie, an off-the-track thoroughbred. She's a lovely little mare, but however, she is too smart for her own good. Mm-hmm. So when she was young, she was banned from the track for rearing and flipping onto her jockey, which is one of the most dangerous things horses can do, is sort of squish you under their body. So she would rear up and she would flip over backwards. And I've been told over and over again by more people than I can count that the only cure for a horse that rears and flips is a bullet between the eyes.
It's well regarded in the equestrian community that that is one of the most dangerous behaviors that a horse can exhibit, because it is very hard to restrain a horse when they decide to rear and flip, and it's also extremely dangerous. It's very easy for a horse to kill you if they flip over on top of you in that sort of manner. So Rosie was banned from the track because she had issues. She didn't want to load in the gate, which I can almost guarantee you she didn't want to load in the gate because she didn't want to go race. She absolutely hated the races. And it's very obvious when you watch the videos of her racing, she stayed towards the back of the pack. She didn't want to go in with other horses. And she definitely wasn't running as fast as she could because she just, her heart wasn't in it, is what I've been told over and over again. And I do agree with that. Her heart was definitely not in it. So she started rearing up at the gate, not wanting to load. And eventually she reared and flipped. And that's when she had an end to her racing career. I was told that she was supposed to be euthanized. However, euthanasia costs money and the slaughterhouse gives you money for your horse. And so she was supposed to go to slaughter, and then she ended up in what's called a kill pen scam, which is where people that work for the meat factories and for horse slaughter industry will take these horses and advertise them and say that they're in a kill pen. They're set to be shipped to slaughter, and they'll sell them for prices that are a lot higher than what they would make off them as meat, as a way to sort of line their pockets and make a little extra profit by pulling on people's heartstrings and saying, oh, this horse is going to go to slaughter if you don't save it. And so people pay these high prices thinking that they're saving a horse from slaughter, when in actuality, they're helping support the meat industry by paying these large prices for these horses. And so because Rosie ended up in that situation, she actually didn't go to slaughter. She ended up with other people and she got passed around. And unfortunately, she had this problem where she would, if she got angry enough, she would just rear up and she'd either dump you in the dirt or she would start to flip. And she would do it on the ground too, not just under saddle. Like if you tried to load her in a trailer, she would just rear up. At one point when I had her, I had a friend who is rather tall who was walking her along, and Rosie's a very large horse and she didn't want to go where we were asking her to lead. So she just reared up and she was so tall that she actually pulled the reins straight up out of my friend's hands. And then she just spun around and galloped in the other direction. And it was very effective for her. This was her way of communicating. It was her sort of no button. If she really didn't want to do something, she could say no by looking stressed, pinning her ears, trying to communicate with us, but humans would ignore her. And so she realized that if she really wanted to say no, she just needed to rear up. And if that didn't work, she could rear and flip. And then at that point, the people would back off. So she had this problem. It was really severe. And so I got her when I was doing traditional training, but again, I was a lot kinder kinder than most people that did traditional training. And there are lots of people out there like that that do a very kind version of pressure release where you don't escalate, you don't use big spurs or harsh bits or like large whips or anything like that. You're going to be rather kind to the horse, but it's still that basis of pressure release, punishment based, like force training. And so I started working with her and it got a little better. But I noticed that one of the biggest things she didn't like was lining up at the mounting block. She didn't like to line up at the mounting block. She didn't like to have people get on her back. And once they were there, she was pretty good, which told me that it wasn't necessarily that she didn't like riding, but there was something about putting the rider on her back that she really didn't like. And what I thought of instantly was that she probably has kissing spine. Kissing spine is a disorder or a disease that happens in horses, where their spinal processes, their vertebrae, actually get bent out of shape from the pressure and the weight of the rider on their back. And the vertebrae start to touch, which makes a sort of like arthritis type pain in their back that gets worse when you add weight to it. It's really, really common in racehorses because they are ran when they're quite young and their bones are still forming. And so I highly suspected that that might be the issue. We got her x-rays and sure enough, she had a moderate case of kissing spine. So anytime there was weight on her back, it was probably at the bare minimum uncomfortable for her, most likely quite painful for her. And so the first thing we did was treat her kissing spine. There are treatments out there. There are ways to help make that better. And once her back didn't hurt, she was a totally different mare. She got way kinder. She was nice at the mounting block. She was just a much happier mare. But at the same time, she still, like, she was quite spooky. If there was something scary, she would startle. And sometimes that startle would be quite large because she was a big athletic racehorse. And so every now and then, like, a bucket would fall over and she would fly across the arena, which is not super safe. And she did have other issues. She would occasionally buck into the canter, which is a sign that she might have back pain. But then after we treated the kissing spine, she would still do it sometimes. She just had these different things that made me think she wasn't super happy. She also exhibited what in the animal behavior community we call stereotypic behaviors. She would stall weave. She would like walk back and forth in her stall. She would nibble at the cross ties and lead ropes. She would like pick them up in her mouth. And as long as she could chew on them, she was pretty happy. But if you tried to take them away, she would get rather upset. And this is similar to how you might have heard of like the orca whales in captivity, how they log or how they do like weird behaviors. Same thing with big cats that like pace their enclosure. It's a result of horses. Well, it's a result of any animal in captivity not having their needs met. So they exhibit these really weird behaviors. So whenever I moved to Missouri and I switched fully to positive reinforcement, I had already introduced Rosie to a little bit of positive reinforcement training, and she had done so well. I called her my Liberty Superstar because anytime I needed to teach a horse something new that I didn't know how to teach, I would start with her because she was just an absolute superstar. It's like she could read my mind. She knew what I wanted her to do before I had to explain it to her. And so anytime I started teaching new things, I started with her. And so when I moved back to Missouri, I was originally in Vancouver, Canada. That's when I made the hard switch to absolutely no force, only positive reinforcement. And that came with a lot of learning. And Rosie was my girl for it because anytime I needed to learn to do something, I would pull her out. Well, pretty soon I noticed she was getting a lot more calm. She was okay being in a stall, which was never the case before. She would literally run over me to get out the stall door if I tried to put her in a stall before. And if I did lock her in, she would pace and be really uncomfortable. Well, now if I let her out of her paddock, she walks up and into the stall on her own and waits for us to start working with her. Whenever we get her tacked up and take her into the arena, she will walk into the arena on her own and line herself up at the mounting block and wait for us to come get on her. And then when she does start working, we always ended with a trail ride at the end of each of our rides as a way to sort of cool her muscles down. And before, she would like explode out of the arena. We had to be really careful with how we brought her over to the gate, because if we just opened it, she would literally like bolt out of the arena because she was so excited to get out of there and go on her trail ride. Well, now we've gotten to the point where there are some days we can't even do a trail ride because she won't leave the arena. She just keeps asking to do more ridden work. And so seeing her sort of behavior change, like this is a horse that reared and flipped, got banned from the track, like had all of these problems, was supposed to be euthanized, ended up on her way to slaughter. All of these problems that I was told over and over again by lots of different people, she needed to be put down. She was too dangerous. And I now watch four-year-olds go up and get her from the pasture. They hold up the halter and she puts her little head down into it. lead her into the barn, groom her, tack her. And I've literally had 4-year-olds ride her, no bit, just in a nice little side pull. And she's phenomenal. She's so relaxed. She's so happy. And she really made me realize that the trouble horses, the ones with the bad behavioral issues that are dangerous, are the smartest horses. She was so intelligent that she knew exactly what she had to do to get by, exactly what she had to do to survive. And she did what she had to make sure that she didn't have to do the horrible things like being forced to race or being forced to be ridden when her back hurt or go places she didn't want to go. And instead of trying to restrain her and force her to do what I wanted to do, given that she is 1,600 pounds and incredibly athletic, I switched that mindset around and I focused on getting her to be willing and making her want to do what I want her to do. And now I have one of the most loyal horses on the property who is just so excited to work and is just such an incredible mare. And that is all thanks to the positive reinforcement and the force-free work. So I like to tell her story as an example of how powerful this type of training is. With even those no hope cases. In fact, I would say especially with the no hope cases, especially with the dangerous horses, these methods are the best ones to use.
No kidding. And it just highlights how even animals, like humans, pain, it comes out. Physical and emotional pain, it comes out very ugly. And if it's treated with kindness, it can make a world of difference.
Yep, exactly.
So what else before we close would you like folks to know and how can they connect with Steph K. Equestrian?
Well, for connecting with me, that's pretty straightforward. You can find me on Facebook or Instagram under Steph K. Equestrian. I also have a website, skequine.com, and you can connect with me on there as much as you'd like. And I have all my contact info there, as well as some other info about like how my program works and lessons and all of that stuff.
And where are you located?
I am in Willard, just north of Springfield.
And you have lessons, but do you also have a need for volunteers?
Yes. Yeah. I actually do a work to ride program. That was something that I sort of struggled with when I was setting up my business is I was trying to figure out how I was going to afford to rescue all these horses and still be able to eat myself. And so the prices I was having to set, I was like, these are going to be so high. Nobody's going to sign up for lessons. And so I decided to try to do a work to ride program and it's been really successful. So lessons typically start at $45 for a 2-hour lesson. However, I also have some students that ride for as little as $5 for that 2-hour lesson because I have a program where you can come do volunteer work and help care for the horses and learn about their care and what's involved in keeping horses and owning them. And as you're volunteering, you're also earning discounts on your lesson prices.
Very cool. That's a fun way to earn your lesson.
Yeah, exactly. I find a lot of the kids really enjoy it. I've had several students that maybe they'll come out and they won't quite have time to do both. I have always just assumed, I'm like, okay, well, we'll do the lesson and less volunteering. And they'll actually request to cut their lesson short because they'd rather be caring for the horses and interacting with the horses from the ground than getting that extra ride time in. And that's something that totally blew me away coming from the traditional training background. Like I know when I was a kid, I just wanted as much time in the saddle as I could possibly get. But I think giving these kids like a deeper connection to the horses is really helping with rather than just wanting to be in the saddle, wanting to compete, they're wanting to spend time with the horses. They're wanting to care for them and they're definitely not afraid of hard work.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for sharing what you're doing with these horses and for folks. And I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to the Twisted Podcast. You can learn more anytime at runradio.net.